You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Albert Einstein once wrote, "The right to search for truth implies also a duty." That Einstein quote tops a letter signed by 708 Americans who want some answers as to how the attacks on September 11th managed to elude intelligence officials in the most powerful country in the world. Approximately 1 year after terrorists flew planes into the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon, congressional staffer Eleanor Hill released a 30-page statement that found information on possible terrorist attacks had been filtered through the nation's intelligence systems in the months directly before the attacks. It specifically mentions a possible attack by Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network against U.S. and or Israel interest that would be spectacular and designed to inflict mass casualties. It warned that preparations had been made and would occur with little or no warning. Hill's report also said the National Security Agency reported at least 33 communications between May and July of 2001, suggesting a possible imminent terrorist attack. Additionally, a 900-page bipartisan congressional study completed late last year remains stuck in national security limbo as the people who completed the report negotiate with the White House and intelligence agencies over which portions of the report can be made public. So who dropped the ball that led to the deaths of 3,000 people in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania? The families of those victims are fed up with the administration's handling of the facts around the tragedy. Lori Van Auken is the widow of Ben Van Auken, who worked in Tower 1 of the World Trade Centers. During a recent interview with Peace Watch, she expressed her frustration with the Bush administration around the 911 investigation.
My first reaction was that I was glad that finally, after 21 months, someone in the government was going to talk to us at a higher level than we had spoken to before. And we were hoping to get some of our questions answered. And that was, you know, going to be a good thing, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of questions were you seeking to have answered?
Well, I have some specific timeline questions as well as other questions, but you know, like specifically on September 11th, you know, we wanted to look at that day first. You know, we want the independent investigation to look at the day of September 11th first,
mm-hmm.
Because the Joint Intelligence Committee has looked at intelligence failures. Of course, the general public hasn't heard anything about that yet because the 800 or 900-page report hasn't yet been released, although we hear it may be released soon. So I had timeline questions when I was at the hearings, the open hearings in Washington. Jane Garvey said that, you know, when Richard Benveniste asked her what time the FAA notified NORAD, she got confused with Flight 77 and Flight 11, and it seems that she let slip the time of 8:34, which I think is probably closer to the time that they may have actually been officially notified. That is NORAD by the FAA.
And what do you conclude from that?
Well, whereas NORAD's timeline says 8:40, I think that they are shortening the timeline because the end of the timeline where Flight 93 crashed, NORAD says that it crashed at 10:03, but the U.S. Army seismic data says that the earth shook and they concluded that the plane crashed at 10:06. So it looks to me like the timeline is longer than NORAD is fessing up to. And I don't really understand why that is. So we were hoping to get some of those answers from Director Mueller, but, you know, he said he didn't know when it came to Flight 93. But that's kind of funny because in his testimony he said 10:03 also, which is NORAD's time. So I don't really know, you know, why he says he doesn't know.
What do you suspect is going on there with the variation of times?
You know, I don't know. I guess we're covering embarrassment again. I can only assume that, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with sources and methods or Moussaoui. And I don't think it's misinformation when it's Jane Garvey and we're talking about U.S. Army seismic data. So I think we can erase that one off the list. So I don't really know. The only thing I can say is somebody's got it wrong or they're covering up embarrassment. Or, you know, I don't really know the answer to that. Mm.
So why do you suppose they have not released the 900-page congressional study on the intelligence failures leading up to September 11th?
We understand that there's still a few discrepancies. I don't know if it's Saudi culpability being covered up or, you know, basically daily briefings that the president might have gotten, or, you know, we don't really know exactly what the discrepancies are. We just know that there are still some discrepancies, and we're hoping that the report gets released sometime soon.
Kristen was quite forceful about the fact that if it means that Moussaoui does not get the death penalty, in order to get information, you know, sorely needed information from other countries that don't support the death penalty, that she could accept that, that he would not get the death penalty. What are your thoughts about that?
I completely agree. I don't think that one dead terrorist is going to make our nation safer. I think that the terrorists that we have right now has information about their sources and methods that could be useful to our government, and I think that getting all the information that he has, you know, that he has, that he owns, that he knows about, would be more important than putting him to death. And I think that if we could get the information from other governments who are forcefully against the death penalty, then I think we should say that, all right, we won't go for the death penalty, and we'll get the information from the other governments and try him for a life sentence.
Mm-hmm. Prior to this meeting, how many times had September 11th families members had a chance to meet with high-ranking Bush administration officials?
One. We met in the White House several times with some people that work in the White House, but the level wasn't as high as Director Mueller's level. So I think that really we'd say that was the first time
and
in
so,
21 months.
And how are you feeling after that meeting?
Frustrated. I think that the operative word would be just plain old frustrated. We really, you know, feel that this is a murder investigation of the murder of 3,000 people. And we really feel that we'd like to have some answers. You know, Flight 93 families got to hear the tape from Flight 93, Flight 77 families, there's some kind of a reenactment of 77, which I don't exactly understand why there'd be a reenactment and not actually be able to see the actual video or the actual tapes. I don't really understand that. But we understand that some families have been asked to, were allowed to see that the reenactment, not all the families, and that came up at this meeting that some of the families would be interested in seeing the reenactment of Flight 77.
And what would you want to see to sort of satisfy some of your urgent concerns about that day?
I would like to know about the timeline. I would like to really just understand, you know, NORAD's response. It seems exceedingly slow. I mean, they had an hour between the time the first plane hit the first building and when the third plane, which was the Pentagon plane, hit the Pentagon. And it's a little disturbing to me that with an hour's notice, that NORAD couldn't protect our skies. So I really think that we all ought to be concerned about that and, you know, understand why we're paying tax dollars into a system that clearly doesn't work.
Do you blame the Bush administration for this?
Well, I guess they're the people in office and the buck stops here. You know, I mean, the commander-in-chief is in charge of, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm sure that there's culpability from prior administrations as well. Mistakes made, you know, from prior administrations as well as this administration. However, I think that this administration and asking to have the investigation blocked is sending a very bad message. Mm. And I mean, now the investigation is no longer blocked, but now the Joint Intelligence Committee report was being blocked, and, you know, it's fight to have that out, and we're talking about, you know, how fast this investigation, the independent investigation, will be over. And we understand, you know, there's some conflict with the new election with this and, you know, in 2004. And I think that's disturbing because really this should totally rise above the level of politics. You know, the people that were to blame that day should really not have their jobs anymore. And I don't mean to be vindictive. I just mean to say that if they're in a position of keeping the nation safe and they obviously froze that day, then maybe that's just not a good job for them. And they really ought to be moved to a job where their response is not as critical.
Any final thoughts on your part, Laurie?
I hope that we get answers. I hope that we can, you know, all work together in this whole country to plead with this government to understand that big business is not the main concern. I mean, you know, it's a capitalist society, but we have to be safe in this country, and we are raising children here. And I think if everybody understood, you know, what was going on and keeping things out of the public eye, I think everybody would be disturbed, and I think that everybody should pay attention and should be asking for answers.
How do you feel about the president's war on terror, and what kind of reaction do you get, say, for example,
the war on terror seems to me to be failing, because I understand that Afghanistan has moved backwards to the Taliban and al-Qaeda taking over again, if I'm reading, you know, reports correctly. Well, also in Afghanistan, the terrorists have been able to flee to other parts where they're taking cover and regrouping, and I don't really see that as, you know, a way to solve our problems. I think that angry terrorists will come after us again if we don't figure out how to fix what's making everybody angry.
Well, what kind of response do you get if you share your opinions and your criticisms of the Bush administration and the war on terror with others? What kind of a response do you get from other Americans? The president is enjoying a lot of popularity throughout the nation at this time.
You know, I guess some people think that he's doing a good job, and they're entitled to their opinion. That's what this country is about, being able to express your opinion. I think that people that think that maybe aren't looking at all the facts. That's my personal opinion. I just feel that we could do a better job here, and I think that everybody would be better served if they were informed about, you know, where we're falling down on the job.
Has the mainstream media given you all an opportunity to really express your views, and have they published your statements and that sort of thing?
The mainstream media has been very sporadic about allowing alternative views into the mainstream media. Sometimes we get heard, sometimes we don't.
Laurie Van Auken is the widow of Ben Van Auken, who worked in Tower 1 of the World Trade Centers on September 11th. The Pentagon is developing an urban surveillance system that would use computers and thousands of cameras to track, record, and analyze the movement of every vehicle in a foreign city. Police scientists and privacy experts are concerned because they say the unclassified technology could easily be adapted to spy on Americans. Meanwhile, increased surveillance and intelligence gathering activities here at home in the wake of the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, have worried many civil libertarians. They fear that federal anti-terrorist legislation, such as the USA Patriot Act and its proposed sequel, the Patriot Act II, are being enacted at the expense of personal privacy and democratic freedoms traditionally protected under the First, Fourth, and Sixth Amendments. On this week's final edition of Clear and Present Danger, Pacifica's 10-part series exploring the challenges of free expression in an open society, we hear about these threats from Charles Lewis, a former investigative reporter for ABC and CBS, who left the mainstream media behind in 1989 to found a nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative research organization called the Center for Public Integrity. Lewis spoke with Clear and Present Danger host Steve Rohde about his group's recent investigations into the Patriot Act II.
Mr. Lewis, on February 7 of this year, the Center for Public Integrity surprised everybody by leaking the Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003, which has now become popularly known as Patriot Act II. Would you describe for us that act, that draft, and how your center came into possession of it?
This is a sequel to the Patriot Act. It's got about 40 sections to it, and it has a lot of sections that are stunning, tectonic shifts in accepted civil liberties and freedoms that we have come to know and cherish. Accepting the detainee thing to the point where you can't even ask with a Freedom of Information request who's been incarcerated, to the Attorney General stripping a U.S. citizen of their citizenship because of an association with a group that's deemed to be associated with terrorism by the Justice Department, on and on. I mean, there are a number of onerous and controversial passages and sections in this bill. A lot of this legislation, of course, came from the first Patriot Act, stuff that they couldn't get the first time that they brought back in this piece of legislation. We're at the Center for Public Integrity. We do investigative reporting research. We've done 225 reports and 11 books over the last 13-plus years. And usually we are the people in the public records room that actually read the records. We're not famous for meeting people secretly in parking garages or anything like that, but what can I say? In this instance, we got lucky and some brave soul made available a copy of this draft legislation. And the two things that astonished us when we received it, the first one was, oh, my God, this is an extraordinary piece of legislation. 120 or 130 pages long. The second thing was that we discovered within days that no one in Washington knew about this. We discovered that not only did the minority, the Democrats on the House and Senate Judiciary Committees not know anything about it, hadn't seen it, hadn't read it, the chairs of the committees, Judiciary Committees, that have oversight over the Justice Department, they had not read it, heard of it. And then we learned that the Justice Department had flatly informed all of them that there would not be any additional legislation or a sequel type, Patriot II type legislation. So the process, the secrecy and the obfuscation about what the administration was planning, the fact that no one had been consulted, even inside their own party, became, to us at least, quite compelling as a important part of the story. And then we went ahead and put it up on the web, because if there was anything we would ever want to put on the web, it was this. It was a no-brainer that it had to go immediately up on the web.
What was the reaction to your release of this proposed legislation?
Well, you can imagine the Justice Department was not too happy. Working with Bill Moyers' show now, they had actually obtained, separate from what we obtained, a routing slip that showed that Vice President Cheney and House Speaker Hastert had seen this legislation. Now, the Justice Department was more upset about the routing slip than they were the bill, because their argument to the public was that the Attorney General had not seen this and had not read it, and it was just like a memo, essentially, an internal document, big deal. People work on things. This is just a draft. What's the big deal? The problem was, if the Vice President and the House Speaker have seen it, then of course the Attorney General has seen it, or he certainly knows about it. And so it was an inconvenient piece of information to be posted on the web. And so they were frantically calling us prior to the posting. And the minute we posted on the web, within 45 minutes, the Justice Department issued a statement essentially trying to downshift the whole thing and make it sound like it was just a memo. It's not usual, of course, for people in government to write 130-page memos that you could introduce in 10 minutes on the floor of the House or Senate. So anyway, they freaked out, and the media and groups all over the world actually jumped all over it. I mean, we had 100 groups linked to our site within an hour, 500,000 unique visitors within 7 days, a lot of major newspapers across America, including the Washington Post and others, ran it on page one. And then the search engines, the Googles, the Yahoo's, the CNN's, and the New York Times, and a lot of groups most of them linked to us, and so it drove up extraordinary traffic. It almost crashed the site, actually. Everyone wanted to read the act. And so it's been a wild time, honestly, for the last several months.
This reminds me of the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg. Why do you think the Center for Public Integrity was chosen for this release?
It's a good question. We're living in a very strange time, as you know, and the paranoia and fear and apprehension factor these days is rather high. So when you have reporters' home phone records seized by the FBI a month before September 11th, when you have that kind of an atmosphere, journalists never tell where they've got something, but everyone is especially squirrely in the current atmosphere. It's just not a happy time here in terms of the passage of information around to the public. This was clearly someone who had a copy of the document, and they were clearly in the government. There's no question about that. I think that the center was chosen because, I mean, I like to think it's because we're respected and a watchdog group that's been around for years. We're nonpartisan. We alienate both parties equally. And we have a popular website that has raw information. We're the ones that posted the Harkin Energy documents about George Bush and his business background a year earlier. We're the ones that broke the Lincoln bedroom scandal about Clinton back in the mid-90s. We're the first to disclose that Bush's top donor was Enron. I mean, we find things out that others don't find, mostly because we read records others don't read. And we also link to large amounts of public records and documents. When we looked at total information awareness in December, we listed 75 Department of Defense contracts to develop data mining with the recipients' names and the amounts of money and everything, and on and on and on. So in some ways, I would like to think we were a logical place. Also, because we don't normally talk about civil liberties issues, we might have been possibly a more credible place, just that in that you don't always hear us talk about that, and maybe that made it more quote-unquote objective. I don't really know what the motive was. I'm just grateful to have gotten it, to be honest.
Did you take any steps to verify the authenticity of the act?
yes, we took a number of steps to ascertain the validity of the document, and we became convinced after a couple weeks of quiet foraging around and talking to people around town and consulting constitutional experts and scholars who were experts on the first Patriot Act and things like that, that we swore to secrecy as we were developing all this material. We came to the view, because I had to, as the founder of the Center for Public Integrity, I was not going to put something on the internet that I did not feel obviously was completely 100% authentic. We also always libel review and carefully vet with a very extensive fact-checking process everything we do here. So this was certainly of a greater magnitude than any of our normal reports. We understood the significance of what we were doing very much. That's not to say that the Justice Department was helpful. The Attorney General wouldn't talk to us. The person who we believe wrote this, Domestic Security Enhancement Act, would not talk to us. That's not to say that they were helpful in trying to in helping us to make sense of it. We understood that they would not be helpful. We weren't surprised that they weren't helpful. But we had enough indications that it was authentic, obviously, to proceed.
You left a career in journalism. You were at ABC, CBS. I understand you were had a stint with 60 Minutes to found the Center for Public Integrity almost 14 years ago. Is the mainstream press today doing its job when it comes to the kind of investigative journalism that was a hallmark of the Watergate era and other times in American history?
Well, the short answer from me would be no. I think that too often what passes today for investigative reporting is putting a hidden camera in a daycare center or something. I mean, not that we don't care what happens in daycare centers, but the important substantive small-d democracy issues in America are issues that are generally not covered by the normal media. And the structure of the media itself, the economic issues that confront the owners of these media corporations and the drive for profits and the quota system for reporters to churn out X number of stories a year or else you're fired, all mitigate against any substantive type investigative reporting. What normally happens in most of the television world these days is what I call the elephant squishes gnat type theory. You know, you go against some obviously corrupt or hapless soul somewhere in a small town somewhere, and in walks a big network and they squish them like a gnat. And you don't really come anywhere near the important power lines, so to speak, the major multi-billion dollar corporations and industries that have agendas, much of which they don't want publicly discussed, or the alignments with certain politicians on various public issues of our day. Those issues are exceedingly complex. They're fraught with peril in terms of libel and other threats like that. And there's financial impediments, the financial disincentives for the media to go near those subjects beyond litigation. So, no, I'm not terribly impressed. And I have tried to create the center as an oasis in the current desert that is American journalism. I travel fairly extensively around the world. It's not any better in any other country. I mean, we may have among the more vibrant dissemination of information societies in the world, but it's still not sufficient for the matters at hand. And so investigative reporting, at least the way I think it ought to be done, is not being done, period.
What prompted you personally in 1989 to leave network television news and establish the center?
A story I produced led the show, and I quit the next morning. And basically, the headline is that I worked on a number of stories, and I'm proud to have been at 60 Minutes. I learned a ton of things. I still have friends at 60 Minutes, and I respect what they are attempting to do. There are a lot of well-intentioned professionals still working at that show. But I came to a point where I decided this was not for me.
It's many years now, so perhaps you can share with us the one story that prompted you to take that step.
I didn't feel that there was a great yearning to tell the complete story, that there might be some punches being pulled, and I just didn't feel comfortable in that setting, and I complained internally, and after the piece aired, I walked. I thanked the folks at 60 for the opportunity. I never did a kiss and tell or never went public, and it was time for me to leave. I'm glad I did it, or I wouldn't have started the center.
Since the segment was publicly broadcast, can you tell us what the subject of it was?
Subject was foreign lobbying.
Now I understand better why your site is called the Center for Public Integrity, because from what you're telling me, you showed a lot of personal integrity. I wanted to touch, as we conclude, on one story that you've released, because the FCC has been at the center of everybody's concerns lately. And you released a report called Well Connected, a report on the frequent travels of the FCC and other telecommunications issues. Could you tell us briefly what you revealed in that report?
We showed what people have suspected for years, that the Federal Communication Commission, an independent regulatory agency, has been co-opted by the people they're regulating it. Over the last 8 years, the FCC commissioners and staff took 2,500 all-expense-paid trips all over the world. The chair of the commission, Michael Powell, took 44 trips. The number one destination was Las Vegas for these guys. And this is being wined and dined, four-star hotels, limousines for these commissioners. And so we also put up the first ever database where you can type in your zip code and you can find out who owns the media within 40 miles of your house. It's the most complete snapshot at this moment of ownership in America of the media. It was a pretty powerful report, 10 months in the making with a team of half a dozen researchers.
Mr. Lewis, we call our show Clear and Present Danger. What do you think is the most clear and present danger to freedom of expression in the United States today?
I think that there is an obsession with secrecy and national security that now has blurred between international and domestic to the point of becoming all-pervasive. And I actually think we have a greater problem in this country with public space and secrecy and what is accessible to the ordinary citizen of any time in my lifetime. I came to Washington during Watergate in 1974, and I have never seen anything like it is now. There's fear, palpable fear and insecurity about information. Most citizens are in the dark about what's going on in their government, and most journalists are unable or unwilling to dig it out. And so I think it's a very worrisome time, honestly.
What is the website for the center?
It's www.publicintegrity.org, O-R-G.
Well, on the eve of the 4th of July, when we're celebrating the founding of this country and the principles for which it stands and the ideals for which it stands, I, for one, want to thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I appreciate what you're doing by discussing these things on the airwaves.
Thank you very much.
Charles Lewis is the founder of the nonprofit, nonpartisan investigative research organization, the Center for Public Integrity. He spoke with Stephen Rohde as part of A Clear and Present Danger. The show is a production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer was Deborah Jones. The producer was Eileen Moskowitz. And the editor was Mark Torres. The show was recorded at the studios of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, and post-production assistance was provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives. To obtain a copy, you can go to www.pacificaradioarchives.org. And to find out more about PEN USA, you can log on to their website at www.penusa.org.
Jesus is tapping your phone calls. He knows everything that you do. So you better fess up and clean up your cup, 'cause Jesus is tapping your phone calls.
The Government Surveillance Yodel by The Fugs. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer today was R. H. Brown. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA and Stephen Push. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.